Mimesis was the term used by the ancient Greeks to describe literature or rhetoric which attempted to reproduce life as it is. Today we would call mimetic literature realistic. We would call realistic art representational. The English word mimic comes from the same root. Now, what has this ancient Greek term to do with Rosh Hashanah? During the course of the relative quiet of this past summer, I had the chance to read one of the classic books on literary criticism written in our century, a work which attempts to detail the history of the realistic tradition in literature, a work written by a continental scholar, Eric Auerbach, under the title Mimesis. And in the opening chapters of this work, Auerbach makes the point that the earliest extended examples of realistic literature, of literature which seeks to give shape and form to life and therefore meaning, the earliest extended examples of this style are to be found in Homer and in the Bible. And he's struck not only by the seminal importance of these two masterworks, but by the fact that stylistically, they come to the task of shaping life from radically dissimilar points of view. They show themselves to be caught up in different perspectives. And the tale of these two different perspectives, or styles, is one which I should like to discuss with you this evening. The eye of Homer lingers long and lingers lovingly on things. His eye is always out for a rich tapestry or a beautiful figure or a fine specimen of mankind. His ear is attuned to the melodies of song and of dance. His hand reaches out to touch some fine piece of fabric or to balance some finely honed weapon. He delights in the world of things, in the world of sensation, in the world of awareness. And in his writing, he makes us share this delight. He draws out for us lovingly and in great detail all the details of the scenes which he sees, the actions which take place, the characters who are the chief actors in the drama. When we read Homer, it's as if we were attending a theater, and the stage is elaborately dressed, and the costumes are extravagant, and the setting is lush, and the lighting is full, so much so that every action, every motion by one of the actors can be fully discerned and described. Nothing is left to the imagination. Everything is there, fully articulated. Now, by contrast, the biblical eye passes over the details of the physicalness of things rather quickly. The biblical eye looks to the shadows rather than to the surface of things. It seeks meaning rather than immediate definition. It's as if we were attending a theater where the stage is bare. Oh, perhaps there's a single rickety chair here and a table there, but that's all. There's no backdrop. There's no elaborate costuming. At most, the costuming is nondescript, a turn of a handkerchief here, a bit of color there. And most of the stage is set in the shadow, so that the imagination must draw out of the action more than the designer placed there. So that the emphasis is on the unknown, on the mystery, on the background of the action. There somehow lies the meaning, of it all, rather than in the foreground and in the surface of things. Now, Auerbach makes his comparison by contrasting two chapters, one from each of these classics. Book 19 of the Odyssey, in which the wanderer returns after 10 long years of being away from home to Ithaca. And chapter 22 of the book of Genesis, the Akedah, the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, the story which not incidentally is the accepted Torah portion for the synagogue for Rosh Hashanah. In the Odyssey, the story of Odysseus' return home, Homer describes to us Ithaca and Odysseus' palace. We see the disguise which the wanderer has adopted so he would not be immediately noticed. We see and are made to understand and to visualize the design and the tapestry which Penelope has woven each day and unraveled each night, because she has promised the suitors that she will marry one of them when the tapestry is completed. The old nurse is described to us, who finally recognizes Odysseus from a childhood scar. Everything is there to be seen. We are made to feel part of the scene itself. By contrast, in Genesis 22, there's hardly a detail. For Odysseus and Penelope and Eurycleia, the nurse, are described in the suitors. Each of them is presented in their individuality and their physical presence. We're simply told that there was Abraham and there was Isaac. They're named. Never a word of description. We're not told if they're tall or if they're short, if they're ruddy or fair-complexioned. There's no description. And though we are described to us at great length the great banquet hall of the palace of Odysseus, the magnificent fireplace, the furniture, the antics of the suitors, all the color and the noise and the sound of the scene, we're told in the Genesis story simply that when God commanded Abraham to take his only son, Isaac, to offer him as a sacrifice, the two of them set out on a 3 days journey, and that's the end of it. They journey for 3 days through an unseen countryside. Not a word is offered to us of description. Is it hilly? Is it mountainous? Is it forested? We know nothing. Simply, and they went. It takes Homer nearly 1,000 verses to tell his story. It takes the biblical author only 19. The Homeric style centers on the thingness of our world, on the world of appearance, the world that presents itself to the senses. The biblical eye, the biblical understanding of our world, somehow concentrates, slips behind that which is the world of appearance, and seeks out the purpose, the meaning, and explanation of it all, if there is one to be found. And of course, in these two great classics, we have a reflex of a national mood. The Greek world delighted in the physical presence of a well-proportioned human being. The Greeks turned to athletics and to drill and to dance in order to more perfectly shape the human body. The Greeks, particularly those of the upper class, had rejoiced in possessions, in well-architected homes, in well-laid gardens, in beautiful vases, and sculpture, and painting. The Greeks were the first people, in, as far as we know, in the history of our world, to think the thoughts which have to do with aesthetics. Why is it that a particular song is melodious? Why is it that a particular piece of art is beautiful? The world of appearances, the world of the senses, satisfied them in a very basic way and preoccupied them to a large degree. The biblical spirit is quite other. The biblical style is spare and lean. We're not given word pictures of the great heroes of the Bible, of Abraham, of Isaac, of Moses, or of any other. There's very little emphasis on human form, on the shape of things. Race is deceitful, and beauty is vain. Now, you know that there's a legend that Homer was blind. And the biblical spirit, I think, would have understood this legend, because Jeremiah the prophet, who lived among people whom he called sated with fat, sleazy, men who were preoccupied with their greeds, spoke of them as being men who have eyes but they see not, who have ears but they hear not. Somehow this preoccupation with the material, with appearances, with the physical form, blinds us to the real meaning, to the deep wisdoms of life. It's not only the statement, better a small morsel, a dry morsel, and quiet therewith, than a house full of feasting with strife. It's not only a statement that we should enjoy the things of life with moderation. The biblical truth, the biblical eye is cast into the shadows. And it says that the world of appearances is really an illusory world to a large degree. But if you want to find meaning, you're going to have to look behind it to see God. Hear not the sounds of this world, but the voice of God. To look for the basic meaning and purpose of it all. Again, what is all this to do with Rosh Hashanah? Rosh Hashanah is called, as you know, Yom HaDin, the day of judgment. And the myth has it that on this day, each of us must stand before the divine judgment seat. And God passes in review our actions of the last year, be they generous or be they selfish, and he passes judgments on our lives. And the liturgy of this day suggests that even as this heavenly assize is taking place, we make a judgment of ourselves. Are we satisfied with the life which we have led? What plans can we make? What disciplines can we undertake which will permit us to live with greater grace, and greater quality, and finer character? Now each of us on a night such as this makes his own private assessment. Each of our lives has its own context. But we're a community. We share a particular time and a particular place. We share particular cultural attitudes, particular prejudices, particular sets of values, particular assumptions. The point I should like to make this evening is that most of us have shared over these last years the Homeric style, the Homeric attitude towards life. That we've been dazzled by things, by possessions, by physique, by appearances. And that our world has come to a point where the wise among us will question whether the Homeric eye can carry us through, whether we ought not to adopt the biblical stance and look at these things with less emphasis and take less delight in them and find a deeper wisdom and a deeper source of happiness. You know, over the last several centuries, man's machines, man's industry, man's technology and our science has poured out a relative avalanche of things. For the first time in the history of the world, more than the very few, the Caesars and the sheikhs and the shahs, could enjoy some of the possessions, the luxuries of life. We had a great deal, particularly those of us who lived in the West, particularly those of us who were of the middle class in the West. Our lives were filled with many things. We had many things that once upon a time our grandparents would have believed unbelievable. Luxuries beyond their vision and their dreams suddenly became acceptable, part of the very pattern of our lives. And we became very much like children, intoxicated with these things. That wasn't that so many of us were simple-minded, single-minded materialists, but it was rather that few of us escaped a certain kind of bemusement, being dazzled by things. How much we talked about the amenities of our homes, the style of our cars, the fashion of our dress, the taste of our food, the flavor of our wines. How much we were preoccupied by things and shape, and taste and smell and sense and possession. All of the taboos, all of the habits of thought which men had built up over the long centuries to protect themselves from wanting too much because there was so little, we let go by the board. Suddenly it was all right to travel with many possessions. Suddenly it was all right to enjoy the fatness of the earth. Suddenly the ascetic life, the lean life, the simple life was no longer the virtuous life. Travel light and work hard, the old Puritan principles we put aside. And we assumed that the good life was somehow tied integrally with the abundant life. And when we asked after a man's worth, we were really not asking about his quality or his character, but about his securities, his holdings. And when we spoke of our times being one in which there was a rising standard of living, we weren't speaking about the fact that our communities were sounder, or our homes better established, or that we had developed new arts of cooperation. We were speaking of all of us seem to have greater purchasing power. We've lived through a time in which there was great promise, great material promise. We were taken up by this promise, and we enjoyed it. We delighted in it. And now comes the time of reckoning. These last months have been months of inflation and of recession. By the standards of the great worldwide depression of the 1930s, this recession was modest indeed. But unlike the great recession of the 1930s, which was so catastrophic in its immediate consequences, most of us sense something is to be radically new in this recession. In the 1930s, we were convinced that when the financial institutions were reconstituted, when the economy was brought out of its slump, we would simply continue from that point to move up and up, to have more, to enjoy three cars in every garage, a deep freeze in every home. But this time, I think all of us recognize that even when the economy becomes sound again, there's going to be less and not more. It's going to be less and not more. No longer can any of us look forward to a future where every adult in a family has his own car. Cheap energy is behind us. We're in the era of public transportation. No longer can we look forward to those thick, fat, encrusted steaks. The world has too many mouths which need to be fed, and beef is simply too inadequate a way of gaining the protein that mankind needs. We're going to have leaner diets, sparer diets. We're going to work harder to pay more taxes to provide for more social welfare institutions required by urban society. We're going to work harder. We're going to have less. Even when the society, the economy, is sound. But what of those who at this period in time have so identified happiness and possession, happiness and the physicalness of things, happiness and sensation? How will they adjust to a world in which there will not be more every year than there was the year before? Where affluence and abundance are dreams of yesteryear and not promises of the next year. What will happen to a husband who has so identified capacity, self-esteem, with his ability to provide abundantly for his family that he cannot assume that his wife can work alongside of him to provide decency for the children, for both of them, because somehow her work offends his amour propre, his sense of self. He has tied his is self-worth to possessions. And what are the parents who are determined to give their children more than they ever had? An inheritance worthy of ancient kings, but who become so frustrated in their inability to build up wealth that they will blacken and darken the relationship which with their children and end without any relationship at all. How will we judge success? How will we satisfy ourselves that we are useful people if we no longer measure worth by our bank books, by the size of our paychecks? And how will we satisfy ourselves that the problems of our world are being worked out if we can't look around ourselves each year and see that we're living with more grace and amenity than we lived the year before? What do we mean really when we say to each other tonight, L'shana tova tikatevu, may next year be a good year for you? In what does goodness consist? More possessions? More worries about thieves and insurance? More wealth? Higher taxes? Or are we prepared to recognize the simple truth that the age of great abundance which we have been through was an anomaly, a period of time which has passed and will not come again, which was due to the open frontier, virgin territory, the first years in which men were beginning to use industrially the natural resource of the world? That we've come to the end of the era of waste, that no longer will 3 out of 4 earthlings go to bed without sufficient food in their bellies in order that we may go to bed with too much food in our bellies. And if you say to yourself, yes, there's a need to redistribute the wealth of the world, but our science and our technology will discover new miraculous ways to produce more, we won't have to give up anything. Others will have more without our having less. Yes, there will be miracles. We had a green revolution. Our agriculturists learned how to help the world produce in the 1960s, in one decade, 30% more food value than they had produced the decade before. And at the end of the 1960s, there were more people suffering from malnutrition than when that decade had opened. We're going to work harder, and we're going to have less. And those of us who cannot shift from the Homeric angle of perception, from the infant's childish delight in the world of things, who cannot avoid being preoccupied by possessions and by textures and by physical presence, are in for a rough go. Endless years of great unhappiness. Now, when I say there's going to be less, I don't mean that we're going to be poor. But poverty is a relative thing. How many of the things that we take for granted today in our lives were just 10 or 20 years to us ago for us dreamt of luxuries? Revolution of rising expectations says simply that the eye is never satisfied with seeing. And those of us who are preoccupied with the Homeric vision are going to fight unhappily against all those things which say to us, you're going to have to live in modular housing rather than custom-built housing. You're going to have to drive small cars rather than large ones, take public transportation despite the inconvenience, wear ordinary clothes rather than high fashion and the like. We will still live graciously. There's still going to be enough and more. I speak not of survival or subsistence, I speak of happiness. Will your lives be lives of endless complaint, self-pity, of whimpering and whining because you can't have any longer what you once enjoyed? Will you look again at the biblical wisdom, the biblical perspective, and ask yourself, how could biblical man be happy even though these physical things, possessions, sensations, meant so little to him? He didn't deny the value of possessions. The biblical philosophy is not one of monastic denial, of asceticism. Biblical man said simply, these are conditional, they're fragile. Don't depend on them. Don't demand too much of them. Happiness is not tied up with wealth. Happiness is the ability to be calm and to do the things that need to be done and be satisfied with the life that you're living, whatever be the condition in which you find yourself. Ashrei ha'ish ha'sameach b'chelko. Happy be them is the man who is satisfied with his lot. And one can be satisfied with little quite as easily as one can be satisfied with much. And when the Bible speaks of joy and of happiness, it rarely ties these things with physical pleasures or with possession. It speaks to us of simcha shel mitzvah, of the joys which are ours because of the duties we perform, because of the good deeds in which we are involved, because we give ourselves to others in love, because we give ourselves to community, to causes of great worth. By giving ourselves, we find ourselves. By doing something that's worth the doing, we establish our own worth by doing it competently, professionally. There are so many ways to be happy, which are independent of the physical possession. We've got to rediscover the secret of finding happiness there. Homer's view of life put everything in the foreground. Everything was rich and luxurious and beautifully detailed. Over the last century or so, men have placed everything in the foreground. There seemed to be no shadows. There was always more. Optimism ruled. Our children would live better than we do, and their children than they. And it was incredible that we should believe this. We had world wars, worldwide depressions. We saw Stalin and Hitler and violence in our cities. But somehow our world was narrowed to the world of things in which we found ourselves, the world of promotion in our businesses, the world of possession and consumption. And in that world, we, the few privileged of the West, were satisfied. We were optimistic. We had enough. But that's not the real world. The real world is a world in which an old man, like Abraham, a man full of years and full of good deeds, a man who throughout a long life had discharged all the responsibilities of a clan chief, can suddenly find his age disturbed by duty. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, and sacrifice him. Give up your peace, give up your calm, give up all those things which are to be the solace of your age. There are no guarantees. There are shadows all about us. And there are shadows all about us. Ours is a world of too many people squabbling for the few possessions that men have. Ours is a world of increasing violence, increasing means of dealing with destruction. Ours is a world in which our cities are fouling themselves. Ours is a world in which the world community is a group of bickering, badgering diplomats scratching each other's faces. It's a world of shadows. It's a world of danger. It's a world in which many of us will find ourselves, like Abraham, suddenly thrust out of the cocoon Summer is over. Winter comes. Now, if our lives are tied up to noble ideals, to love, to family, to all the worthwhile things, it need not be a winter of discontent. And if we have the courage of an Abraham and have traveled light and expect the shadows, then we can do what needs to be done, even if we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, a certain promise. And then perhaps, like Abraham, we will come to the point when the ultimate sacrifice is demanded, and suddenly there's a ram thrust by God into the trees, caught there by his thorns, a surrogate. It turns out well. And according to our tradition, the horn of the ram caught in that thicket was the first shofar. It is God's promise of redemption to mankind. We sound it on Rosh Hashanah each year, hoping for redemption, hoping for deliverance. How we need it. How we need to be delivered from the jungle that is life. And somewhere out there in the shadows, behind the world of things, behind the world of possession, behind the world which cannot satisfy, there is the world in which God lives and acts. The world where, for those who have courage and conviction, who are obedient to the will of God, and who obey the duties which God imposes, somewhere out there is the world in which God fulfills his promise. The horn is sounded. Deliverance comes. I wish for each and every one of you a Shana Tova, a good year. Not a year of things, but a useful year. Not a year of more possessions, but a year in which you give yourself over to work which is worth the doing, causes which are worth the achieving. Not a year in which you worry about your dress, but a year in which you worry about your soul. You find satisfactions for your soul, creative outlets within the circle of your family. A world in which you help others to grow into their maturity, which you offer healing and love and learning and advice and counsel. A year of decency. A year of sacrifice. A year in which you are the offering. For an offering yourself, you will find true happiness. Amen.